What kind of law do you practice?
Maritime law.
On what grounds could you possibly prevail?
Grounds? Who cares about grounds? Cases always come down to who the jury likes better.
Mr. Foley, I must warn you that if you attempt to belly rag or bulldoze this witness, I shall take very dim view of it.
Your lordship is most pretty.
Very well, then you may proceed.
Cash settlement. I could have figured that out, you button-down maggot!
You have any cream?
Oh, yes, of course. Where are my manners?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 367. I'm Thomas Smith. That's P. Andrew Tortoise. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine, Thomas. How are you?
Well, you know.
I do.
Doing okay.
I do. But I'm excited about today's episode.
I am excited about today's episode as well. It's going to be so fun to talk to the two gentlemen behind the music algorithm, the every melody ever. Really interesting stuff. So that'll be fun. Before we get to that, though, Andrew, I know we wanted to tackle a listener question. So why don't we do that? It's a, you know, it's wild card segments. Yes, they sometimes go to a graveyard and just drift away. But other times they, you know, haunt us like a poltergeist. And we then answer them later. So that's what's happening here. An old wild card segment you wanted to get to. It's a great listener question. Hit it, Brian.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
So, Andrew, what is our listener question today?
Yeah, this, I thought, is incredibly timely. It is March. People are thinking about making law school decisions. I know we have a bunch of prospective law students. And this came from a current 1L at a T14 law school. And I should say that T14, right, that's shorthand for top 14, that is, right, Harvard, Yale, Stanford are the undisputed top three. And then the other 11 schools in various order are Chicago, Columbia, Penn, NYU, UVA, Michigan at Ann Arbor, Berkeley, Northwestern, Cornell, Duke, and Georgetown. So they are kind of roughly grouped into that T14 designation and you know, carry cachet, right? Carry prestige. So I thought this was an incredibly interesting letter, and I just wanted to share it with our listeners because I know we have a lot of folks who are thinking about law school, and I wanted to share the perspective. So this listener says, listening to your last episode, the last time we talked about law school admissions, and I said, essentially, you know, make sure you know what you're getting into, right? It's potentially a lot of debt, and don't wind up like me where you get sort of funneled into big law practice. If you want big law practice, great, but don't accidentally get thrown in because you don't really know what's going on. That was sort of my takeaway message. And this listener says, I thought the financial advice you gave was not quite as on point as some of your other analyses. Going into law school applications, I did not know what the T14 was, and I only applied to four schools total. I ended up getting into all of them. I've always been interested in environmental law. I never really took prestige into account in making life decisions. But when deciding between two schools ranked highly in my chosen field with a lot of scholarships and two T14s with less scholarship, I decided it was time to bite the bullet and go into debt. I know this will be different for everyone, but even going to these lower ranked schools with a complete scholarship, I would still have to pay for all my living expenses, which would mean some debt. And let me do another little sidebar here. Just to be clear, my point was not don't go into debt for law school. And it definitely was not. I mean, I would be pretty hypocritical if it was, if I was saying, don't go into debt for a top tier law school. That would be a pretty silly thing for a Harvard grad to say. My point was and is to know what you're getting into. But I All thought right. this next part really deserved highlighting because I have not talked about this in terms of scholarships. And this is really the part. All of it, I think, is useful. But this is the part I really wanted to make sure I read. Another thing I didn't realize, but know now, was that one of those offers from a lower ranked school was a conditional scholarship, meaning that I would have to maintain a certain GPA to keep the scholarship. While that didn't seem daunting to me, some institutions place all the people with scholarships in the same section, meaning they have to fight each other to get a place on the curve to keep their scholarship, and guarantees that the school doesn't have to pay out all that money for all 3 years.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's some dirty tricks.
I can't verify that independently, right? But what I can say is, and different schools have different conceptions of whether there is a grading curve and where that models. That data is publicly available. You can track it. So for example, right, we know that historically University of Chicago's grading curve tends to be lower than other schools, right? That's true undergrad. It's true for their law school. That data is publicly available. So my takeaway there is not, right, law schools are or are not out to screw you out of your scholarship, but is, number one, know the conditions of all of your scholarship and have access to the data, know whether this is, you know, conditional, unconditional, whatever. And then this person adds, also, law school is hard and I have enough to stress about without worrying that I'll lose my scholarship. That's a good point. It really is. Listener continues. Most, maybe all, T14s have the loan forgiveness program you were discussing, but at least at my school, it's called LRAP, the Loan Repayment Assistance Program. They'll help make loan payments up to a certain salary, which varies by school, and in some cases isn't exceedingly generous. My school's is very generous, making your payments for you up until you earn $100,000 a year. But some schools put limits, like not qualifying for clerkships. And then I'm gonna cut. There's a discussion about how that interacts with the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. And the punchline on PSLF is that there is a less than 1% success rate of people qualifying for loan forgiveness under PSLF, and Trump and the Republicans keep trying to gut it. So I certainly agree with you that from a political standpoint, I mean, it's almost as if this should be a campaign issue on how to make college and post-collegiate education more affordable. So yes, but let me go back to the conclusion. Overall, law school is massively expensive, and it's good to know that going in. Going to a less expensive school may be a good option for some, but you still have to be careful. And as much as I hate it, I do get better opportunities going to the brand name school. Another thing I didn't know is that first year salaries, right? And particularly in the part of the country that this person is in, the first year salaries are, you know, six figure salaries. And even a summer associate position, that some of the offers this person got were as high as $40,000 for the summer. That was more than I made as a summer associate. But it is a good point, right? I am not saying that you don't increase your earning potential. I am not saying that you can't, take that and then maybe pay off a chunk with what you've earned as a summer associate. I just thought all of this was a really good kind of balance to the perspective. It doesn't change my underlying point, which is I don't want to hear stories of people kind of being blindsided the way I was. But I wanted to share that with everyone. So there you go.
Well, there you have it. Wildcard segment accomplished, Andrew. Eventually. Good job.
That eventually is a fair criticism there.
All right. Well, the great question and great answer, Andrew. Let's hop on the line, though, with Damian Real and Noah Rubin, and we are going to talk about algorithmically generating every possible melody and hear it straight from the horse's mouth. So why don't we grab them on Skype?
Awesome.
We are joined by Damian Real and Noah Rubin. I hope I pronounced your names correctly. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks. And yeah. Real is correct.
Cool. So we covered the Vice write-up of your of your project last week. Why don't we go ahead? Because in my opinion, that was a little bit confusingly written. So why don't we go ahead and do a reset? Why don't you give the, if you don't mind, the short version of, you know, the project, why you went about it, and that kind of stuff, just to keep everybody up to speed.
Sure, I can start. Noah can catch in. This is Damian Real. So what we thought about is Noah and I were involved in cybersecurity, and I've been a lawyer since 2002, been a coder since 85, for the web since 95. So as a tech lawyer musician who has a bachelor's degree in music, I was thinking a few years ago, I thought, what if, much like you can brute force a password, brute forcing the password is AAA, AAB, AAC, till it guesses your password. I thought, what if we could do that with music? What if we could go do 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 re do 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 mi until we mathematically exhausted both every melody that has ever been and every melody that can ever be mathematically? So exhausting the entire possibility of the melodic data set. During an engagement, a cybersecurity engagement that Noah and I were on site, we finished a very long day and went back to our hotel. And in the lounge, we were discussing the possibility of this. I said, Noah, do you think you could brute force passwords? And Noah answered affirmatively.
My answer was, I think, explicitly, yeah, sure, I'll give it a shot. Why not?
and he's a really smart dude. And so initially it started out as a thought experiment. We thought, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to be able to do this? And as a, I've taught copyright law at a local law school, and I've practiced in litigation in copyright law. And I knew that to be actually effective, it has to be in a fixed, tangible medium. And so we thought about the ways that we would actually put it into a fixed, tangible medium to be copyrightable, at least arguably copyrightable. But then as we started thinking about the project, I started thinking about the larger legal implications and started thinking about what had annoyed me since I went to law school and heard about the George Harrison Chiffon's case, the He's So Fine, My Sweet Lord case. And I thought about how unfair that case was, that George Harrison, the court, the judge held that he subconsciously infringed. And it struck me as really unfair, even as a third-year law student, it struck me as unfair that every other area of the law requires some sort of intent. But this, it not only didn't require intent, it didn't even require consciousness, that you were even aware of doing something. And so that's thing number one that bothered me. And thing number two that bothered me about the George Harrison case is that essentially George Harrison was put in the position to prove a negative, to prove that he's never heard a song before. And from your philosophy, you know that proving a negative is logically impossible. One cannot prove that you've never done something. It's an impossibility. So that has put every defendant since George Harrison in that impossible position to have to defend, I've never heard a song. And how can you prove that you've never heard a song over the loudspeaker of the grocery store? That's number one. Number two is that, you are always going to lose because if your song is famous enough, that defendant is always going to lose because you can't consciously show that you unconsciously didn't do something. Those things were very annoying.
Yeah, I was going to see if we wanted to jump in on this topic of the law or the music first, but as an amateur musician, I have thoughts on that. It's so funny because while I don't have nearly the background that you have, as a person who came across that lawsuit who's into music, I actually had a totally different reaction from you. So I want to say this, jumping into this, when you present the melody, just the melody of My Sweet Lord and He's So Fine, you know, da da da, I agree with you. Like, it seems like such a, you know, it's three notes or something, give or take a little bit of a flourish here or there. That seems unfair. But like, I think of it differently, which is, it's also the exact same chord structure and timing, which if you were able to add in all of those variables. Now, George Harrison's song is like, I think it's shifted down like three semitones or something. So instead of A minor to D major, it's like F sharp minor to, B major or something like that. So, but it's still the same exact timing and it's still the same exact chord relationship. So, and to me, like, if you were able to account for how many different variables all those things would be, time signature, timing, the chord relationship and how they all line up exactly, I always thought in my mind, well, yeah, I mean, honestly, he probably heard that song and didn't know it. And I agree with you. It's interesting to talk about like intent. So maybe there's something there. But I always took it as like, oh yeah, he accidentally did this. And since this melody and chord combination already existed as a hit song, like it makes sense that he should have to kind of give them a little bit of credit for that. So I always had an opposite reaction to that you have, I think.
So I think that yours is a reasonable reaction, and particularly for somebody who is just I don't want to say just an amateur musician, but somebody who has a passing familiarity with music thinks, oh yeah, that's what are the odds of accidentally stepping on that other thing? But I would say, you know, the people that are professional musicians that I know have similar reactions to mine, because we've kind of professional musicians have exhausted the melodic possibilities and exhausted the chordal possibilities and exhausted the kind of structure of a song possibilities. And, you know, if you think about the blues structure, for example, and then the 1-4-5 chord, and those are really common. And really, that's what My Sweet Lord and the Chiffons is, you know, 1-4-5 and maybe a 3 or a 6 thrown in there. So the exhausting that chordal data set mathematically and exhausting the melodic data set, as Noah and I have shown, and then exhausting the kind of the song structure side of it. Each one of those things is not very large of a combinatorial data set.
I don't know. Once you combine it, though, and given the fact that the melody comes in on the same syncopated rhythm, like there's a lot. If you were to map that out mathematically, it would be infinite. Like it would be so much.
Right, that was my point. Any one of those things would not, you know, they're mathematically small, but then what I was going to say is the combination of those things. You're right. The combination of those together, that is a harder sell to say that it was accidental. So I would say that, you know, the use case that Noah and I are trying to address is the ones where it's just over the melody, or just one of those very small, finite mathematic combinatorial data sets. If you put them all together, as he did there, that's a tougher sell, but you're still faced with the intent question. Did he mean to do it?
Well, and that is a truly professional segue to me coming in, because I wanted to tackle the sort of prove a negative question, because in my view, that's just a reworking of the same intent question as applied to copyright, right? So for example, in copyright, to make your prima facie case, you have to show that that the allegedly infringing work actually copied your work, right? And so you could imagine this unpacking a straightforward, you know, this is just being a subset of the intent question generally, right? So I go forward and I say, no, I just had this fantastic idea about writing a book about the French Revolution. And, you know, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times, right? Like, I've never read Charles Dickens, like a tale of two what, right? And at some point, right, In any kind of case, right, it becomes a fact question for the jury to say, all right, like we just think we get it. Torres got on and testified that he created this all by himself, but you know, we introduced records that kids read A Tale of Two Cities in high school, and there was a copy on his shelf, and it's, you know, been reprinted 100 million times, right? And so it's sort of the totality of the circumstances lead us to infer that my testimony that I didn't copy that is maybe not reliable. And so I see, I have the same kind of reaction as Thomas as a musical idiot, but as a lawyer, I kind of have the same reaction, which is this didn't seem strange to me, right? That like you would say, okay, the evidence, right? I mean, yeah, He's So Fine was number one for, you know, 11 weeks, right? It's everybody knows He's So Fine. Yeah. And so, you know, it's not even though Harrison is saying, I promise you, I've introduced testimony, I definitely didn't copy this. Well, you know, like, let's just kind of put all the testimony together.
Sure. And counselor, I'd like to respond, and if I could.
So to
your previous example of Tale of Two Cities, right? So the combinatorial data set of the English language is 100. So the math on what we did is do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. So there's 8 up, and then we repeated that 12 times. So the math on that is 8 to the 12th power, which is 68 billion, okay? The math on language for Tale of Two Cities for that is the number of English words is 117,000. So it's instead of 8 being the thing, it's 117,000. Right. So repeating 3 words is 117,000 to the 3rd power, which gets into the gazillions, right? It's lots and lots of zeros. In contrast, the My Sweet Lord is 3 tones And it's repeated 5 times. So the combinations of that is 243 period. So I think the real example is, you know, what are the odds of accidentally stepping in that 1 and 243? Pretty high. So that's thing number one. And thing number two is the point about, proving things, and we, as you say, in courts, we prove intent all the time, and that's proof through facts, et cetera. But the problem is that, it takes between $500,000 and $2 million to get past the discovery stage to the summary judgment or to trial. And a lot of these cases, if I'm a songwriter, that it's brand new, I don't have $500,000 or $2 million, therefore I roll over. And it seems unjust.
So yeah, I definitely want to hit on the equities of that situation first. But before we move past on the combinatorics analysis, let me not ask it as a leading question, right? let me just sort of make the argument, which is, it seems to me that there isn't a great bright line between 68 million and, 52 quintillion or what, whatever the Tale of Two Cities was. And so that seems to argue in favor of however bad it is, the jury approach, right?
Right.
Yeah, look, like, okay, we get it. You can't sue me because I said, the cat ran in my book and so did Vonnegut in, Slaughterhouse-Five, right? Like, but at some point, right, the odds of that get too high for us to infer any kind of accident. And the fact that there's not a bright line is kind of what juries do, right? And what you've criticized in these cases, which is they sit down, they listen to both performances, and they decide, kind of given the totality of the circumstances, they are certainly not doing combinatorial math in their head. But their intuition probably aligns with that, right? They're like, well, three notes is not a big deal, but three notes at the same time, right? It doesn't that. So put all of that together rather than do it as a leading question. Doesn't the lack of a bright line suggest that this should be a fact issue for the jury?
If I could just give a bit of my perspective on this a little bit. So what we're talking about is the issue of, we have this large data set. How are people sampling from the data set? Right, because we can say we generated 68.7 billion melodies. Mm-hmm. A lot of those are not going to sound that great. I think we can all agree on that. It was worthwhile to do and necessary, right? And we're proving a point, but not everybody is going to use all 68.7 billion in modern common music, right? I want to be careful saying modern common music because everyone has different tastes, but the type of music we're optimizing for is, like Billboard Top 40 type popular music. But so the point is, we as humans are not, uniformly at random sampling from 68.7 billion melodies. We're picking stuff that sounds good, right? And so to a certain extent, what sounds good to us is what we hear out in the world. And there is a bit of a gray area there. But the point I'm trying to make is that the question of whether or not someone infringed in this type of case, or the burden of proof is not beyond a reasonable doubt, it's more likely than not. And so it's really it's a question of probability, right? So if we as humans are not uniformly at random sampling 68.7 billion melodies, the set is actually much smaller that we're choosing from. This is the point Damien's trying to make, right? 243 is a small number. But if you take, let's say, melodies of length 8, right? It's not let's say it's not 12 to the 8, right? We're not, mm-hmm. but it's something much smaller because a smaller set of those sound good in general. And then if you pick a genre, it goes right. even smaller than that. And that also applies to, for example, time signature and tempo, right? The key that this song is going to be sung in. Just because I choose the same time signature, tempo, and key as you, that doesn't mean I'm infringing. It means we're both singing, country music or hip hop. Mm-hmm. And so the point I'm trying to make is you're right, there are emergent properties when you combine things together. But to a certain extent, genres of music sort of hold certain things fixed. And so
reduces the variables, essentially.
Yeah, right. you're saying you add all these things together and there are more. But what I'm saying is actually a lot of those are held fixed. And so you should ignore them in certain cases.
And to put this in the legal context, there's something in copyright law called sans-effet. And that idea is that a movie you can't have, you can't copyright the idea of the guy in the black hat tying up the woman to the train tracks and then the guy in the white hat saving the woman, right? That is not a copyright element because that's every Western is that. That's sans faire. So kind of what we're arguing is that melodies, because they're especially in a particular genre of music, melodies, there are only so many chords in that are common in blues, right? You use the blues chord, you use the blues structure, right? That's sans faire. So what we're asking is not to break new ground in copyright, but to say that melodies perhaps are just sans faire.
Well, when you put it that way, I mean, I might agree with you. Like, I almost think when you're talking about this really simplistic top 40 pop melodies, maybe they should just be rights fee. Like, if you're just talking about the sequence of notes. So I take that point. I would suggest, though, when we're looking at these cases, it's one thing to take the extreme case one way and to say, look, how do you know, they didn't know this. You have the example in your TED talk of a baby sing something into a recorder and then Taylor Swift. I just would, what about thinking about it the other way, though, which is I come up with a song and I say, it's, hey, dude, don't make it mad. You know, and I just like, okay, well, then you're going the other way and saying, well, since we've come up with all these melodies and made it free for everybody to do without, now that opens the door the other way to where you just obviously rip off all these songs and there can no longer be any recourse.
So, of course, the law is not in any of those extremes, but it's almost always in the middle.
Oh, and so, I did want to say, like, sorry, real quickly. Like, one thing we all, I think, can agree on is that the law has been applied totally haphazardly and weirdly. Like, I don't ever want, our side of this argument, if there is a side, to be that the law is working properly, because it's absolutely not.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think we can all agree on that. And I think one of the reasons of that is because it's haphazardly by nature by judges that are not necessarily expert musicians and by juries that are not necessarily expert musicians. So you have this, 50 states and federal and state, patchwork of bad cases that ultimately end up with bad law. So I think I would agree with that. But thinking about, between the extremes is the more likely scenario. And so I would say that something that your listeners and every musician should think about is examples such as Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, which has the same melody as Ba, Ba, Black Sheep, Have You Any Wool, which has the same melody as A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Those three songs, exact same melody. I would guess if I were to say a percentage of our listeners who knew that they were the same melody, I would put that in the maybe in the 10% or less. And the reason for that is they're three separate songs. Even though they share the same melody, they're three separate songs, and we identify them as three separate songs. So I would say that that realization that those three separate songs share the same melody is a kind of aha moment. And I would put that in the copyright infringement context as a gotcha moment. You know, the chiffon said, oh my gosh, the My Sweet Lord, that sounds just like ours. Gotcha. And then I'm going to sue you. So what I would say is that because the two songs stood on their own and you have to really think about it to realize that they share the same melody, maybe those two songs are independent and you know, hey, dude, that's easy, right? Of course, that guy copied it. But having, almost every one of these cases is, oh, wow. Yeah, I guess I didn't ever realize that they had the same melody. Well, that's because they're different songs.
So I want to explore that a little bit. You said, hey, dude, that's obvious. And I guess my first question is, in your view of sort of the evolution of copyright, how do we identify that as an obvious case? Right. Because to me, the reason that it's obvious is because we've stipulated.
Because of the lyrics. But if I change the lyrics, that's actually less obvious than the examples you've already given. You know, I mean, that's very few notes. So it seems like that would be even less. If I go la da and just make up words, about something else, like I feel like a lot of non-musicians aren't going to recognize that.
And if I just could add one thing, which is the thought experiment that we're sort of going through right now is, let's take a song and pick apart all the elements that make that song potentially distinguishable from another one. And then let's start peeling each layer away. Not really a layer because they're sort of stacked. But anyway, you peel each part away and you say, okay, I peeled this one away. Now is that, is that copyrightable? I peeled this thing away. Is that copyrightable? I peeled this thing, right? So you have arrangement of instruments. You have lyrics. You have all these other things. And you have, Marvin Gaye would argue, you have groove, right? You have all these things.
Some people who own the rights to his music would argue that, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to pin that on him specifically. But anyway, the thought experiment is a good one, and I personally don't have a great answer, but I think the bar should be higher than just melody. And I think we both agree on this, right?
Yeah.
And so we agree that there are emergent properties when you combine things together. I think that should be teased out a bit. And I think this thought experiment is a good one, and we can keep going through it. But the point is, I think where we're going to end up is, if you just are left with the melody, right? That's the thing that makes them so similar, substantially similar. We're arguing because of, you know, they're finite and we're not uniformly at random sampling them. That should not be considered as something you should be able to sue someone.
I thought that really nicely sort of laid out the issues. Let me ask the question, right? Because now we can, for purposes of the hypothetical, just assert intent, right? So this is the Vanilla Ice case, right? Like, I now say, hey, I'm going to go out, I'm going to take a very, very popular song, and I'm going to completely rip off the melody, right? It is
the baseline.
Is there any, I'm changing it. Sorry.
Melody of the baseline?
I'm making an analogy here. So it's Schmanella Schmice, right? And Schmanella says, yeah, again, unlike our universe's Vanilla, makes no bones about it, right? Admits, I totally, right? Reuben and Reel proved you can't copyright a melody, so I'm totally ripping off every melody I can find, and I'm just sticking new lyrics on it. Is there any room for that? I mean, how do you respond, right? How does that fit into the framework?
I think it's a fine question, and that goes to intent. So, and I talk in my TED talk, TEDx talk, about early stage evidentiary hearings. And so maybe if that early stage evidentiary hearing, Schmanilla Ice, says that, then I think we're talking about a different horse race, because there's not accidentality, if that's a word. It is purposeful. And therefore, I think, at least in my mind, puts it in a different category. But it could be argued that, if melody equals math equals fact equals uncopyrightable sans faire or otherwise, then maybe we should, as a society, think about, does Schmanilla Ice or the person that Schmanilla Ice copied from, do either of those people, should they have a monopoly, a government-provided monopoly, which is what copyright is, a government-provided monopoly of life of that person plus 95 years over what is arguably the building blocks of music, melodies.
So that is an absolutely perfect transition to the question and the issue that I wanted to ask. But I do, I want to summarize that I think you wound up sort of where I wind up in listening, which again is not... So now I think that sets up kind of the overarching question, which is the biggest one that I had in terms of the equities of the situation. And let me kind of give the counter argument. I know you've heard it before, right? All of these cases that we're talking about are, by definition, because this is the incentive in copyright, is to find an incredibly successful pop song and then get a piece of it. So our defendants are Katy Perry, Robert Plant, George Harrison, right? Like, these are
Robin Thicke or whatever.
Right.
That was the worst.
These are, by definition, the kinds of people who can afford really, really good quality representation. And yes, one of our recurring themes on our show is the difference between an early motion to dismiss and going to trial, and trials are expensive, and that's a recurring theme. But if anybody can afford going to trial, it's probably Katy Perry. She's going to be fine. The flip side of that is, when you talk about new music creators, and again, I say this as a musical idiot, but the people who are uploading 50 million new songs per year to SoundCloud that you talk about, maybe we should be erring on their side, right? These are the artists who are just barely out there, trying to get their break, and I worry about a world in which a Thomas Smith can write a fantastic song, put it out there, and then, you know, and then, you know, Warner Brothers can come by and, you know, Schmanella ice it up and say, oh, yeah, great. This is, we are totally copying 100% of this. We're going to hand it off to Katy Perry, and she's going to make $50 million out of it. And Thomas, hope you enjoyed those downloads off SoundCloud. Like, you know, good work, but there's no copyright on your work anymore.
So I would have a response to that. So first, I would question your premise that certainly I would agree that all the cases that we hear about are the Katy Perrys and the George Harrisons and the people that have money to defend themselves. But I would query your premise as to those are the cases, because anybody who's litigated, and everybody has, knows that the first thing you do is a cease and desist letter. Yeah. How many Katy Perry type lawyers and record label lawyers write that cease and desist letter to that small guy, that small woman, that small songwriter saying, hey, your new song actually sounds like my song. And then those cases go away before anybody hears about them.
So let me jump in and just for our listeners, this is what you're describing is a subset of the joke you made coming on, right, of copyright troll litigation. And it is a real problem that is a real argument that is valid. So yes.
Cool. So the example of that is that, you know, for example, Tom Petty was alleged to have reached out to Sam Smith saying, your stay with me sounds like my won't back down. And so Sam Smith, you know, he rolled over and gave Tom Petty co-songwriting credits before they went to trial, before they did anything. Mm-hmm. And if I were Sam Smith, I would have done that too, because I would have looked at the situation where if I, Sam Smith, go to trial, I'm going to have to prove a negative, and they're probably not going to believe me anyway. So I will have spent $2 million or so on defense fees, and my song might not even have been worth $2 million. So how many, you know, and Sam Smith is famous. So how many less famous people in his position essentially look at the inequities of, well, why would I even, and I don't know if I can swear on this thing, but why would I even fight this thing when I know that I'm going to spend a lot of money in legal fees and I'm almost certain to lose because I can't prove a negative.
So you raised that example in the TED Talk. I elided over it because I'm going to have to confess to my listeners, I don't know who Sam Smith is. I do know Tom Petty. This will not surprise anybody who's been a longstanding listener of the show. What I take away from that is still, this is a very popular song, right? And yes, there was an accommodation reached sort of in order to avoid litigation. But again, I don't know that that triggers my response of wanting to intervene in an equitable sense here, because again, you're talking about sophisticated parties represented by lawyer, right? Like, I mean, you know, Tom Petty didn't write the letter, right? Sam Smith didn't answer, right? You know, Tom Petty can afford lawyers that are, you know, twice as expensive as you or I, and Sam Smith can do the same. And I still don't know, even in that case, right, where you have sort of one artist, you know, potentially extorting the other out of a songwriting credit and out of a split on the revenues. I don't know that that outweighs my indie producer, you know, my indie creator who now, you know, is at real risk of predation by these, you know, huge music companies that are out there.
Sure. I mean, and that is a possibility. You know, I, as a successful musician, might be trolling SoundCloud to try to find melodies that mm-hmm. I'll be able to use in my next song. And maybe that happens. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But
yeah, well, I mean, I think Warner Brothers can pay somebody to do that. It's not even Warner, Time Warner, AOL, Taco yeah. Bell now, whatever. Right.
It really does seem like it would open that up and we would have no recourse. Any amateur musician would have no recourse.
But I would say that go back to Twinkle, Twinkle, Ba Ba, Black Sheep and ABC. Would anybody recognize the same song as the SoundCloud song versus the Warner Brothers song? And if they can't, and if it seems like, oh, yeah, I guess it's the same, then you have the gotcha side. And should any particular person, even if the small SoundCloud person, should they have a monopoly of their life plus 95 years over the building blocks of music? And I would argue no. And I think the odds of the Sam Smith, Tom Petty situation where the big person comes down to the little person once they make it big, I think that's a much more likely scenario than Warner Brothers trolling a bedroom musician.
I would also like to add that, yeah, I feel like we're kind of talking about the scenario that you just talked about, Damien, the larger entity, whoever it is, trolling SoundCloud or whatever and finding inspiration. I feel like we're talking about that as if that doesn't happen already. Right? It does. For example, there are numerous hip hop musicians who have admitted to some guy giving them a mixtape and then them copying them.
Right.
Right. Eminem is a great example, and he has zero remorse for it, and he has not paid the price for it. I still love Eminem. Don't get me wrong. My favorite rapper of all time. But I feel like we're talking about this as if it does not happen. It does. Right. So I think the question should be, given it already happens, would it happen more if we all agree that melodies are math and thus facts and should not have copyright? I don't know. I think that's a tough argument. And I think on the flip side, if a bigger, let's say Warner Music Group or whatever it is, or Sony Music, let's say they come to me, my indie hip hop artist, whoever it is, and they say, hey, you copied us. I think we're more likely to help the little guy in that situation than to give Sony the right to troll SoundCloud in some way that's more permissive than they already do.
Can I jump in? Because I think, A, yes, it would only lead to it happening more. I mean, I can't imagine if you relax the standards, why wouldn't it? It would either be the same or more, and my money would be on more. But I got to say, I thought I was kind of agreeing with you guys. But if the stance is that melodies are math and therefore you shouldn't be able to copyright them, everything is math. You can reduce everything to math. The entire world could be reduced to math. I was agreeing on the assumption that it's like, well, this finite melody range, this kind of top 40-esque, you know, just the melody within a few bars, that might be something where it's like, all right, we've gotten to the point where there's too many people making music. This has all been done. There shouldn't really be any great claim to like three blind, like whatever that little simple thing is. But if you're saying any melody, like no matter how long, no matter how, you know, if you're saying any melody shouldn't be able to be copyrighted, I would strongly disagree.
No, I'll let you go first.
Yeah, let me just say one thing to be more specific. We're saying they're countably finite. And again, I'm going to go back to this sampling thing, not music sampling, but there's the finite set of melodies that you could possibly use. And then there's the much smaller subset that people actually do because they sound good. And so our argument is not that they're math and that's over, right? They're countably finite. And the subset that people actually use are even smaller than that. That's the short of it. But Damien, go ahead.
And I was going to say a similar thing, and I would add to what you said is really the question is accidentally being able to accidentally stepping on it as a small data set versus a very large data set. The number of English words and the combination of that is, you know, for to say the same 12 words in a row accidentally, you know, brute force wise, there are more grains of sand on Earth than there are the possibilities of doing that. And so it really, that's a much different scenario than 243. Three pitches by five notes. So I think it's a degree of probability.
Well, again, but you guys are stopping at a certain level of granularity. You could add timing in. You're stopping at what? A sequence of 12 notes that are, I guess, quarter notes in a, or whatever you want to do the timing. I mean, you could do fine grain granularity on that and say, you know, if we're doing 32nd notes, if we're doing, you know, 16th notes, whatever it is. And it would very, very quickly get uncountable, or at least infinite, to the point where it wouldn't be reasonable to suspect. So why is that not the case? Maybe we get more fine-grained on how we view melodies. We look at all the little intricacies and not just look at it as, oh, it's these three notes in a row. Oh, it's how long is that note? What's the rest between them? How long is the, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure. But think about that, you know, any creative expression. So you have language in copyrightable written works. You have paint in visual works. You have sculpture in 3D works. Of the arts that are copyrightable, music is the most mathematical. You know, we have the diatonic scale has eight pitches from, I guess, seven pitches. And then if you add the top tonic, it's eight. Mm-hmm. So there are more than that number of colors. There are 117,000 English words. So of all the copyrightable works, visual art, written, you know, music is of its own thing. And so I would say that, you know, the odds of stepping on the same melody are much higher than the odds of writing the same short story.
Yeah, I would agree.
So can we all agree, you know, there's the case that we talked about briefly on the show, I think, Andrew, which was the blurred lines one,
mm-hmm.
which that is not clear to me what, I mean, even if we took your guys' approach, that seemed to be a case that relied on it kind of sounding-ish the same. Like, I don't even know what criteria the jury used. I guess the feel or something. So
that's a case
that regardless of whether, you know, you and I agree or disagree, like that still is just a totally inane thing in my opinion. And that's a part of music law that I don't think any of us thinks is in good.
On that, I 100% agree. Yeah, and that groove was a travesty. That the fact that you can steal the feel of something, and I've been trying to think about why that decision happened, and my theory is that we as a society have essentially decreased the amount of funding for music education. So, you know, whereas people used to be able to, you know, go to grade school and figure out what notes are and pitches are, we've decreased the funding for music education. Therefore, the judges are generalist judges and the juries in public, they just don't know how music works. They haven't played instruments and they don't really know what melodies are or the finite possibilities that we've all been talking about during this podcast. So if you don't really know how finite the data set is, then you're more likely to hear two songs that sound similar and say, oh, of course that person stole it, because, you know, there's an infinite possibility of being able to, you know, you could make anything you want. You have a blank page and you chose the exact same thing. They just don't realize that the finite data set is so small.
I endorse that as well. And
I want to live in an alternate universe where the response to that is, hey, maybe we shouldn't write the same piece of crap song every single time for a top 40 hit. There's a reason why Elliot Smith is not being sued by anybody for his melodies copying. They're longer, they're more intricate, there's more chord changes underneath them. That becomes truly infinite within a few, you know, if you don't repeat your melody for long enough, if you're not just repeating these same notes, it really does add up. How infinite it can get. But I take your guys' point that when you're within that reduced kind of range of creativity that pop music is mathematically like been demonstrated to be in, that maybe it should just be public domain to a certain point.
I just want to make one clarifying point that we're not saying that we want to protect people who are not creative.
good.
We're making an argument that is separate from how creative you are and how intricate your melodies are. But I think, you know, if we go back to your question about, you know, let's say somebody comes along and they take the exact same melody, they just put different lyrics on top of it. I think what you're getting at is, and what we missed in that thought experiment, are the other layers that go on top of the melody and in between right. The melody and the lyrics. Right. And I agree. If you have higher complexity in your songs, then, anyway, go ahead.
No, I think that's an excellent point. I think that road leads back to everything being a question of fact and going to trial, though, right? Like the more what you say is that it's a question of, right, straight copying of a three note sequence in a melody, does not infer copying, but, you know, taking a complex melody and just sticking a couple new lyrics over it does, right? That seems to get back to the same problem in the first place, which is that we're not getting early motions to dismiss in copyright cases. Go ahead. I'm sorry. And then I do want to ask a geeky process question because I can't help it.
Okay. I just have one other thing, which is, this is a personal opinion, not necessarily speaking for all the music LLC here, but what you just said is important, right? And I think it gets down to, we have some decisions to make as a society about how we want to move forward with music copyright. And I think that the question is, and Damien brings up this point a lot, right? Do we want people who are trained to judge the law and not music to be making those decisions? Or do we want to try to come to some decision as a society or people that genuinely care a lot about this and then lobby for that thing?
I was just going to add on top of that, that when we think about what we want to protect, it is a circular firing squad, because a songwriter might be suing today, but they might get sued tomorrow. So, we often in these thought experiments, as I've been talking, we always put ourselves in the person that got ripped off. But that person that got ripped off today might be ripping somebody else off tomorrow. So this is not a one side, you know, I'm against songwriters, I'm for songwriters, because songwriters are on both sides. I think songwriters need to think, okay, if I'm on the staring down the barrel of a gun, what situation do I want to be in? And how does that balance against me trying to shoot somebody else for ripping my stuff off? And so I think that what Noah was saying, us needing to think about it as a society, and I would argue as musicians, what should we as musicians say, yep, that's yours, I'm not going to rip that off, versus, no, that's everybody's. That's just the musical scale. Yeah. Everybody should be able to use it.
Well, I think I brought this up, Andrew, did we do, what was the Katy Perry one? Because we covered that, right?
Yeah, the Katy Perry was someone that I had never heard of. As the plaintiff.
I think the point I made on that one was, like, when it gets right down to it, in today's pop music environment, how much a percentage of the revenue that Katy Perry is making on this song is because she went da 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 instead of da da da? You know, like it's none of it. Like it's almost none of it.
That is exactly the image.
Yeah.
That's 100% correct. Yeah. And I would also argue that the particular melody in the Katy Perry wasn't even as complex as you just demonstrated right there. The particular melody was starting on number 8, right? 8887776. That was it.
Yeah.
So and there was no complex rhythm there. It was literally quarter notes. That 8887776 was the full melody. That's $2.8 million for that.
Yeah, that's terrible. That I think we can all agree on that being terrible.
And so then another thing on that before we leave Katy Perry is that particular data set, that particular melody that I just said, is in the All the Music LLC melodic data set 8,162 times, because that is length 8 and we have length 12. So that is so necessarily that melody is combined with four other notes at the end of it,
right.
8,162 times. So this is not a creative thing, and we've just demonstrated mathematically how uncreative that melody is.
We can all agree on
that. So yet again, you've done a fantastic job of setting up the segue. But before we do, I'm going to ruin it because I want to endorse what Noah said and the spirit behind this conversation, which is I love that we are delving down into, you know, legal minutiae to talk about the equities of the situation. I think we all agree, you know, that this is a subset of an area of the general principle that there are lots of laws that do not accurately reflect changes in technology. And so one of the messages of the show is, right, let's think and talk about whether we need to re-envision that. So I didn't want Noah's point to pass without us signing on to that.
Well, I was going to add one thing onto that, which is I think I mentioned that when we talked about the Roundup case, right? Because some people may disagree with us, but that's a case where I believe that science was really done a disservice and that, a jury of non-scientists was convinced of a non-scientific thing.
Yes.
And I think it can happen the same way with music. Like, is there some way to get more expertise involved? I guess I'll ask this to you, Andrew. Is there any way to get more expertise involved in these decisions, or is it always going to be a case of, you know, it's just a jury of whoever and they have to get dueling experts to try to convince them?
Well, and I mean, you started to answer your own question there, which is having this dialogue will change future cases. And I would not be surprised if any of the folks on this conversation were engaged as expert witnesses in future litigation matters, because that's what I would do if I had a defendant at this point. I would hire Damien and say, I want you to prepare an expert report that explains the mathematical likelihood that this is that no copying took place. And if you prove that if no copying took place, then the plaintiff does not have a prima facie case for copyright infringement.
Yep.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Vistaprint. Folks, the most important time is now. It is important to feel professional, polished, and prepared when it counts right now. For small business owners or people who produce their own podcasts, doesn't sound like anyone you know, being plugged in and prepared when an opportunity comes is crucial. These moments happen all the time. They're happening right now. And having a business card that shows how professional you are in your pocket, ready to hand out, is the first step to making something happen. Your next big opportunity is coming right now, and we're here to help you own the now with free shipping on any business card in any quantity. Choose whatever style, finish, shape, or paper you like and get free shipping. And because you can pick the colors, fonts, designs, and images, it means you can create something as unique and compelling as your business. So, are you ready to get started on your business card? It's easy. Plug your information and logo into hundreds of fresh designs tailored to your type of company, or upload your own original layout. Pick the paper stock, style, and quantity that's right for you. You can even upgrade to a unique touch like rounded corners. You order and receive your cards with free economy shipping. And as if you needed any more reasons to choose Vistaprint, you can feel good knowing that Vistaprint uses only carefully selected inks and responsibly sourced paper stocks. Your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or your money back. They'll make it right. So, Vistaprint wants you to be able to own the now in any situation, which is why our listeners will get free shipping on all business cards, any style, any quantity. Just go to Vistaprint.com and enter promo code OA for free shipping on all business cards, any style, any quantity. Limited time offer. Own the now at Vistaprint.com, promo code OA.
I see that as sort of part of the program, and that gets me to my geeky process question, which is, do you don't have to register the copyright on the hard drive that you've created, right? Under the burn condition, it's now fixed medium. And but do you intend to do that? And I have a couple follow up questions. If you do, go ahead.
That's a fine question. So we are. So your question kind of goes to the primary question for, is our data set copyrightable or not? And the premise of the question is a machine created work copyrightable or not? Because ours is a machine created work. And so there's two answers to that. And I would say the answer number one is a machine created work copyrightable. If the answer is yes, it is copyrightable. We have therefore copyrighted it under the Berne Convention. All you need to do is a fixed tangible medium. And then we have pushed it into the public domain under Creative Commons Zero, dedicated to the public domain. So that's thing number one. If the answer to that question is no, thing number two, if a machine-created work is not copyrightable, I would say that the legal scholars and other lawyers in our audience should think, okay, why is it not copyrightable? Is it not copyrightable because it's A, unoriginal? Or is it not copyrightable because B, it's fact? And I don't think I haven't been able to think of a C. So if it's either unoriginal or if it's fact, and if it's indistinguishable, if that what is in our data set is indistinguishable from something in The Flame that sued Katy Perry, that dun 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 dun,
those are the same melody. That's what it was, yeah.
Yeah, so if The Flame is indistinguishable from Noah's and my data set, then should Flames be copyrightable or not? So I would answer two things. If copyrightable, then public domain. If not copyrightable, then that proves our point anyway.
So I don't know if this is a potential C, but your data set, I could certainly see, because as you've pointed out, you've created this project and then immediately put it into the public domain. So you don't intend to sue artists for infringing upon your copyright. You intend for your data set to be available as a defense in future, as an affirmative defense in future copyright actions.
Shield, not a sword.
Right. And one of the counterarguments that the plaintiff is going to make is that your copyrighted work is not valid because it is in and of itself a compilation of lots and lots of melodies that predate your work, right? So in other words, there are tens of, every melody from every pop song ever recorded prior to 2019 is now included in your data set. So it seems to me that could be a C, right? That a court could say, yes, machine-created works can deserve copyright, but this machine-created work is the equivalent of a novel that has multiple chapters that are, even if they're machine, you could brute force, it was the best of times, it was the blurst of times, right? And put that all in. And a court would say, yeah, the problem is there are too many unprotectable, otherwise copyrightable elements within this. And that would be the worst case scenario, right?
Yeah. And so I would say to your question, what if somebody sues us because we've infringed every work that is copyrighted today?
Well, not sues you.
Say, go find it. Point to it in the hard drive. No.
But I mean invalidate, right? Because you intend for it to be a shield. So, I mean, challenges the validity of your copyright vicariously in, litigation between, Katy Perry and some other songwriter, right?
Right. Sure. And I think that would depend on the, so we'll call the first songwriter as Adam, and then we'll call the second songwriter Beth, right? So Beth is alleged to have infringed Adam's song. If Adam wrote their song before 2019, when Noah and I started doing our data set, that's a different scenario than Adam creating his, say, in 2020, after we've created our data set. Because in 2018, that would have predated ours. In 2019, that would have post-dated. So I would argue that if, under your scenario, that was the 2020 Adam, then I would say, ours predated his, so we can't even argue that I copied him.
Yep. I want to commend you on lawyer short, correct answer, right? Like that. So this is really prospective.
Wait, I thought, Andrew, you were saying I thought you were saying that the whole thing would have been maybe rejected because it contained.
I want to explore that second half first, but I wanted to flag the first part, which is even if you think the whole thing is copyrightable, it's copyrightable for future songwriting, right? Because then this will predate, not so, you know, let's mash up all of our things. If Katy Perry records a song and Robert Plant says, hey, that sounds an awful lot like Black Dog, right? Then this does nothing with respect to that particular lawsuit, because Black Dog predates the composition, unless we move to music equals math equals, you know,
that's exactly right. And that goes to my question one, copyrightable, yes, versus copyrightable, no. Right. So let's say that's right. A and B. So if copyrightable, yes, then you're right. If copyrightable, no, then it would still come into play.
Yep. So now then let's move to the second half of my hypothetical, which is assuming that melodies are copyrightable. What's the status? And I ask this as a genuine question. I don't know. What's the status of a work where large chunks of that work are otherwise copyrightable elements that predate the work?
Are you talking about our data set, or are you talking about
right? Let me see if I can't give an example. Do you since you and I are of a similar age, do you remember? I do them as a child. The group Stars On.
Right? I'm sad to say I don't know.
Okay, well, what they did was they would sing medleys, right? And they would license, and they would sing 15 seconds of popular songs, right? And so they would license, you know, 15 seconds of I Want to Hold Your Hand from Apple Records and 15 seconds of, you know, various other songs. But they also had some of their own creations in the middle. So their albums would be like 48 songs long, and there would be like three or four original Stars On songs in the middle of this album and 45 15 to 30 second samplings. But again, recognizing the copyright, like they paid to license to sing 30 seconds of I Want to Hold Your Hand. And so it seems to me that the argument would be that the original stuff that Stars On did in the middle, if that was all one publication, and now we're really, you know, pushing the analogy a bit, but if that were one creation, right, there are sort of two potential responses to it, right? One is to say, no, the overwhelming majority of this single creation are works that are copyrighted by other people, so the whole thing doesn't deserve copyright protection. The second view would be, well, most of it is derivative, but there are a handful of original things in here, and so at least those original elements deserve protection. And I don't know, I'm asking it legitimately as a question, if the second view of the universe obtains in copyright law. I suspect it's an open question.
No, well, and so I think there are analogies, and law lives on analogies after all. So in the copyright law, I think what you're talking about is a derivative work. So if you have, say, an original that is a public domain work, so we'll use the example of, you know, Beethoven's Fifth. If I do a cover of Beethoven's Fifth, or it's actually, this actually happened, right? So the disco song, the dun-dun-dun-dun, right? That's a cover of Beethoven's Fifth. Obviously that disco artist did not have copyright in Beethoven's Fifth, but they did have copyright on whatever they built on top of Beethoven's Fifth. So Beethoven's
Fifth. There's also that other hit from the 60s that was that Beethoven song, or maybe it's Mozart. The da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Exactly. Yeah. And Cat Stevens
had Morning is Broken.
Yeah. Cat Stevens had Morning is Broken. Right. So, I mean, there's all sorts of examples of hit songwriters covering public domain works. And so the law on that is for that derivative work, for that thing that was based on a public domain thing, they of course don't have copyright in the public domain thing, but they have copyright in whatever they added to that public domain thing. That comes into play both with Noah's and my data set and with your question, I think, is that, you know, what would there be? And I would say that, you know, maybe if melody equals math equals fact equals uncopyrightable, then that shell of the melody is something that you can't have, much like you can't have Beethoven's Fifth. But you can have all the other things around it, right? That disco song was a lot of things beyond just Beethoven's Fifth. And they have everything except for that shell of Beethoven's Fifth. So you can have everything around it, just don't keep the melody.
Well, and yet again, I wasn't going to sort of this late in the interview introduce the concept of derivative works, but it strikes me that there's a risk there, and I guess I'll end with this because I know you have a hard out as well, but the right to produce derivative works is one of the bundle of rights that goes along with copyright. And so the more we shrink the scope of what qualifies as copyrightable, the more we're shrinking that as well. And so it just, I think that needs to be factored into the analysis.
I agree with that. Yeah, okay. I agree with that. And I guess maybe at my closing, since we're coming close to the end. So I agree that we should really think about whether, the derivative work should be something that should be protectable for melody, or whether that should be the shell, much like Beethoven's Fifth is the shell that everybody can build around that shell, but just the core itself can't be done. And so really the summary of what Noah and I have done goes to the question of, do we copyright the thing that is the ache of the voice, the way that a guitar really wailed, all these things that machines cannot do, and separate that from what Noah and I created that spit out at 300,000 melodies per second onto a hard drive. Machines do melodies really, really well today, and they're going to do melodies really even better tomorrow. They can't do the ache of the voice. They can't do the wailing of the guitar. So query whether we as songwriters want to say, okay, leave to the machines what the machines do well, but leave to copyright what is uniquely human, the stuff that machines can't do that really, when you think about it, the person doesn't listen to the Katy Perry song because they really liked that combination of pitches. They love that Katy Perry song for the reason you said earlier, because of the way she sang it, because of the groove that she had, all of those intangibles that are not the melody. Let's leave the melody as the building blocks that everybody can use.
Can we have you back on for a long argument and episode on autotune? But no,
exactly. I have some feelings on that.
I thought perhaps you might. I like that summary. Noah, anything you want to add?
No, it's pretty good.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us, Damien and Noah. Hey, do you want to point people? I know, yeah, they've already seen the article. They've seen the TED Talk, I imagine, TEDx Talk. Is there anywhere else that you want to point people to check out more about this project and stuff you're working on?
Yeah, allthemusic.info is our website. So there you'll be able to see the TED Talk. You'll be able to see the interviews, including this interview. We'll put that on our press page. And you'll have a very lengthy frequently asked questions, which you can imagine the internet has some opinions on what we've done. And so we've collected all of the objections that we've had and put them into a FAQ that you can peruse and be able to throw rocks at if you'd like.
I have to say, this FAQ is exactly what you would expect when you take a lawyer and a computer programmer and have them itemize a list. Even if I don't agree with everything that's said in it, the organization is a thing of beauty.
Yeah, you guys are nothing jealous if not systematic. No one will ever say you're not systematic.
I felt like I was drafting a brief when I did that FAQ.
I felt like I was reading it. It was fantastic. I got lost in it for like half an hour. Guys,
this was so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
And thanks. And thank you for having us. We love having this dialogue. Thank you for continuing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, guys.
And now it's time to thank our top patrons here on Top Patron Tuesday. These are our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats. They deserve even more praise than we give them, but we're going to do our best. Andrew, start the shout-outs.
Yeah, thank you to Minneapolis Live Show. I'll bring twins tickets. A holding action for your right to party. That's such a great Beastie Boys reference there. Samuel Bland, Mitch McConnell's Yodel Mountaintop Removal Service. Ouch. Brian Lehman, wow, this list is so freaking long. I'm still with her, Warren 2020. Well, I think it's probably time to change your name, yeah. I'm afraid. Support your local search and rescue volunteers and baseball law podcasts. Yes, yes, you should. This Patreon name is a lot more pressure than I was expecting. Airbud 20, Amicus Bark. There's no rule that says dogs can't be lawyers.
Surely Patreon can think of a better pun than that.
That Amicus Bark, yeah. We hereby invite Silk to join the Lionel Hutz Laudawful Movies. We've had one Super Tuesday, but what about this second Super Tuesday? Hell with my inner child. I'm getting in touch with my inner curmudge. Ziegenhagen, oi, oi, oi. A series of question marks and unpronounceable characters. That's not the name. It actually is that series. Ian Buckley, there's always money in the banana stand. Kristen Daniel, Thomas Smith is the Ted Olson of co-hosts. Aw, that's so great.
I don't know what that means.
Oh, well, somebody didn't listen to my baseball law lecture.
Oh, yeah, no, just the parts I had to edit.
Yeah. Air Bud Golden Receiver is Michael Vick's villain origin story. Ouch. Murray Gregerson, yikes. Colleen Wilson, Christopher Brown, Lawful Copter, India is shooting students protesting against bigotry. Can we get CERT to appeal all of Thomas's incorrect T3BE answers? Support co-ops and not-for-profits. May I remind you of Space Corps Directive 34124? I don't know which one that is, but always a good Crichton line. Amber Green, the doctrine of daylight savings time is our deference. H-O-U-R. Cog Dis is my favorite podcast. OA gets more money. Well, I love that division. That is, let's keep that up.
Yeah, we can support that. That's
we
fine.
We can make the show worse.
I don't care what your favorite podcast is, as long as you're donating more to us.
we love Cog Dis too, but I got to tell you, if making the show worse will get you to give more money, we will do that. Let me be totally clear. Torres Smith 2024. I think that makes some assumptions we don't want to make, but we'll go. Clear eyes, full hearts, totally clear. Zirkle, Freudian face plant. Barry McCockater. Cat dead, details later. Gosh, I hope that's not true.
I hope that's a joke or something.
Yeah, really not a good joke, but if so, no one likes dead kitties. Gorsuch, Anna Soul. Emily Rainbow Spence. Who keeps demanding Andrew estimate things at gunpoint? Jason Copas. Man Chicken will happily receive all junk mail on Thomas's behalf. Well, I think that's binding on the USPS now. So there you go. No more junk mail. Looking forward to the 2020 Marble Olympics. Thank you, Gels Marble Runs. Okay. Raleigh Durham Live Show. We have spaghetti and blankets. That pitch is not doing great. Like, you should say you have Tyler's Tap Room. That's a fantastic place to go hang out. And anyway, I'm behind Durham. So
right now the pitch is less disease. Yeah, I think is the
is spaghetti a non does spaghetti kill coronavirus? Don't take medical advice from this podcast. My blanket, my blue blanket. Give me my blue blanket. It's legal. It's advice. It's opening arguments live in Vegas. Yeah, eventually. Hotspur live show in Barcelona will make up with tapas and sangria. What? Tapas and sangria will get me to Barcelona. Just fly us out there, Hotspur. Michelle Cloud, poop is funny. Poop is in my butt. Ergo, my butt is funny. Well,
they will make a Harvard attorney say.
This is why Thomas was like, I really think you should take the first set of names today. Nate Drex, spoon feed your kid from the grave because you know they are a clown horn. Stuff and polls, Darth Mandy Pants. Alexa, remind me to vote on November 3rd. Aluminum Brewing, 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. Airbud 6, bark spin. Bark spin?
I mean, what sport? I mean, lots of sports might require backspin, right? Like golf, volleyball, tennis. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what sport that is. It's better. I'll say it's better, but I still don't totally know what sport you're talking about.
God, my device is still talking to me from having to set that patron name. So that's amazing. Volunteer for your candidate today and take back your government. Crying in my whiskey because April 4th is the weekend. I'm not home in Seattle. Well, now you can feel somewhat better about that. We changed that just for you. Jennifer Cratch, remain indoors. I'm here because Diogenes the Cynic was right. Time to nude the movel. Spaghetti, the noodle without a moral arc. Steven Balticate Sandoval, shop at Jita 4-4. I have no idea what that's supposed to mean, but there we go. Hey, Steven. Jeff Gelbach. I have lost the will to be funny in this nightmare timeline. Well, you know, being funny is one of the few things we can still do in this nightmare timeline. So I urge you to recover. I am drummer, no melody, only rhythm. How appropriate for today's show. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio and the Registry Matters podcast. Thomas, take it away you have more butt jokes than I did.
Yeah, I don't know. John Bilderback, insurance adjusters for Trump 2021. Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious, Seattle, home of Westland Distillery, tons of corgis, and future OA live shows. Gerrymandering is an abuse of power. I am the very model of a modern attorney general. Eric Alsman, Warren 2020, Warren 2020, Warren 2020. Payne Strumpet, Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew is a close second. Well, this happened. I guess I'm a Bernie bro now. Yeah, you and me both. Clownhorn the live show. I just want dinner in Seattle. Catherine Connell, Napoleon, Kiowa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. The Wandering Gambler. If precedence has you down, make it original with pretext. Milo Meadsong stands in solidarity with UW nurses and their union. Love you, Thomas, but Jesus, make up your T3B mind. You're killing me. Mike Lit Horace. All right. Avoiding despair with genital puns. Our first and only favorite karaoke legend, Cosmo Blues. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Air Bud Cinematic Universe. That was fun going through the Air Bud Cinematic Universe whenever that was. I don't even remember. Was that last week's episode? Someday this podcasting empire will rule the galaxy. James Cole, no coronavirus can't be cured with a slice of lime. Adam Costa, no. Chad T, anonymous. J. Alden Walt, the internal body temperature of a tauntaun is lukewarm. Still funny to me. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Trump's lawyers give clownhorning idiots a bad name. Closing concessions. Buttercup's Legal Services, a proud sponsor of OA's Music City Live Show in Nashville, Tennessee. Septuagenarian Deathmatch 2020. Yeah, pretty much. Which one will get coronavirus last, I guess, is the question. Derek, the little people's opinion on sports law doesn't concern a patron. This pod brought to you by The Righteous Fury of E. Warren. Yeah. Andrew, what case can I turn to? 867-US-5309.
Still good. So good.
Big easy blasphemy. The Yodeler achieved escape velocity and is now in orbit. Volunteer this summer. Learn more at campquest.org. Rhonda wants an Alaskan live show before it all melts. Atlantis is my favorite Stargate. Universe is a distant last. Malaika Chandler, Abacus Flinch, David in Brooklyn, Soggy Pants, Harry Balzac, Matthew Vernon, Sam Buck, adopt a homeless pet and opposed to clawing and ear docking. Don't take ramp building advice from a podcast. Heather L. Sakashite's infinite monkeys with typewriters own every OA script ever. Yeah, someone pointed out the Simpsons reference that should have been made in that last music episode. We'll use it for this one when it's like, it was the best of times, it was the blurst of times. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium. Ian and Ollie, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, Men Are Trash, But I'm a Raccoon. Nice. Alexandra Chalupa, a.k.a. Natasha Crunchwrap. Mitchell, I'm a Leaf on the Wind, Seattle Live Show Swag Bag, Lysol, Rubber Gloves, and what is that? Hibiclins? What are those? I don't know what that is. Sorry. Maybe I got to get up to date on my disease prevention. I don't know. Contagion prevention. I agree with that 100%. And finally, Conrad Michaels. Thank you, folks, so much.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand.
I need your clothes.
That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
And now it's time for T3B Answer Time. Whew, I gambled on this one. Did it pay off? Let's find out.
All right, so this was a question regarding identification of a suspect. So, store owner, jewelry store gets robbed, shown a photograph of the defendant by the police detective, and the store owner examines it, says, hey, is that the guy you think is the suspect? And the detective goes, yeah, we're pretty sure. Then the store owner says that the man in the photograph was definitely the one who robbed her. The defendant gets indicted. His counsel moves to suppress any trial testimony by the store owner identifying the defendant as the robber. Should the court grant the motion to suppress? As always, whenever you are bold, I love being bold, and you right off the bat said, yeah, the court's going to grant the motion to suppress. That's a bad idea. I'm eliminating the no answers. Good elimination, Thomas. It came down to C or D, and you talked yourself into D while evaluating through the questions. So let's go over both those answers. C is yes, because the improper out-of-court identification has necessarily tainted any in-court identification. And D was yes, unless the prosecution demonstrates that the in-court identification is reliable. You were leaning C and then talked yourself into D. And Thomas, you came to the right answer.
Oh, man.
Absolutely. Wow. Great. And now this is a hard question, and you got it exactly right. And,
all right.
And you got it exactly right for the right reasons, right? Which is to say that what makes C a bad answer is the word necessarily, mm-hmm. right? So even if the process is tainted, which obviously like this was super bad, right?
Just imagining, I mean, what if the store owner's like, yeah, it's my brother. I know they showed me the photograph, but like, I know who did it. You know, is that what it is? Like,
that leaves is, open that the is idea. Exactly right. Right. That what you do is you do an independent analysis that is a multi-factor inquiry as to whether the witness's identification is reliable in court. And you can do it for precisely that reason, right? And by the way, this also is part of the explanation for at the beginning of every Lawful movie when they say, you know, can you point at that, you know, that the defendant over there,
yeah.
and the witness does that, right? Like that's what you're doing, right? That the reason that has become a trope is because it reflects part of what actually happens in a trial, which is you have not just an out of court identification of a victim, which would be hearsay of a defendant, which would be hearsay, but you have an actual in court identification, which is then subject to that multi-factor analysis that we discussed that can be reliable even if there were procedural problems and anomalies beforehand. So, but notice, by the way, the burden shifts, right? Like the burden shifts back to the prosecution to justify the identification. But you can for exactly the reasons that you came up with. So fantastic job,
Holy
Thomas.
Moly, that was, wow. I mean, I don't know what to say. I guess I'm just a real life lawyer now.
I agree. I mean, that's it. We're done.
Because like the safe answer, I think, from my perspective, was C. You know, and my philosophy is go with a simple, safe answer. But I was able to like come up with an exception to that actually worked. I just feel personally, this is an achievement for me. But yeah, all right. I'm happy. Let's find out who else is happy, because they are the big winner this week. Who is it?
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All right, Thomas. This week's winner is Hampeltier on Twitter. And thank you for the hyphen, by the way. I would have pronounced that Hampeltier. But Hampeltier writes, D, because criminal law tends to protect incompetent, biased cops, giving them a second chance most suspects will never get. Also, Thomas chose it. So congratulations. Hampeltier also says A seems maybe a little too broad and unspecific. B, if that's not improper, what is? C, because in-court ID might be independent. That is correct, pithy, appropriately concerned about the state of law enforcement. And you have a ham-related name. So congratulations, Hampeltier. Enjoy your never-ending fame and fortune. And everyone, give this person a follow on Twitter. That is at Hampeltier. And congratulations on being this week's winner.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Hey, thanks so much to our special guests, Damian Real and Noah Rubin. That was a lot of fun. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And we will see you on Rapid Response Friday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission. Does spaghetti kill coronavirus?